What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Damage Report with me, Francesca Fiorentini, Stepmama Dragon, MILF Dragon, whatever you want to call me. I'm here once again, and joining me for this Thursday, Dan from the internet. Dan Evans, what's going on?
What's good? It's so great to be here. I felt like we were talking about this earlier on. There were Fran Mondays, then there were Dan Mondays. Now we have a Fran and Dan Thursday, as for someone intended. I don't know, as our wonderful producers intended.
It's like a yummy dessert. I feel like we've done this before, but a Fredan, like, yeah, Fredan Thursdays.
Yes.
Well, you know, it doesn't always have to be an amalgamation of names. It could just be.
Of course not.
But that just being said, if you've got suggestions, throw them out there. I'm so excited to have you on. We've got so much to talk about, including Mr. Andrew Tate, who honestly should, after this, be disappeared into oblivion for how much he's honestly self-owned at this point. We've got some January 6th updates, what's going on with COVID in China, and then a heartwarming story to round up everything in the aftermath after we look at. Also, Kevin McCarthy, not really a shoo-in for Speaker of the House. So we'll look at what is going on the Republican side of the aisle. But first, you know what to do, guys. Like the like button or press the like button. Share the stream. Let people know what you are watching, what you are getting up to on this Thursday between Christmas and New Year's. You know, they say nothing much happens, but we got a lot to talk about. Okay, so do that for us. And with that, Dan, are you ready to get into this?
I'm excited to get into this. Okay. Some things more excited, some things less, but let's go.
Indeed, indeed. Isn't it always like that? Well, okay, the January 6th hearings have concluded, and we now have access to a bunch of transcripts and information that we didn't have. And that is actually informing decisions on criminal prosecutions of not Donald Trump, that's just a suggestion, but of people who are actually being prosecuted, which are Donald Trump's cannon fodder, if you will, his followers, the MAGA base, those who stormed the Capitol that day, particularly in one case of his name is Alexander Shepard. There we go. Good name. Shepard, and boy, was he a sheep. Now, the judge in Alexander Shepard's case ruled that actually his defense that he was just following the president, and because it's the president, it must be legal. Nah, that doesn't hold water. In fact, let's go to this. Judge John Bates, a GWB, that's George W. Bush appointee, used the committee's findings to swat down a January 6th defendant's contention that Trump's rally rhetoric led him to think he was permitted to go into the Capitol. Trump's fight like hell language did the opposite, Bates ruled. Bates ruled the defendant Alexander Shepard could be prohibited from making the quote public authority defense because there's simply no evidence Trump told his followers that entering the restricted grounds of the Capitol on January 6th was legal. Trump's incendiary rhetoric, especially telling his supporters to fight like hell, may suggest Trump was asking them to break the law. His words could signal to protesters that entering the Capitol and stopping the certification would be unlawful. So right, you can't say, well, officer, my dad told me to break into this house and he's my authority. Or like a police officer told me to do this. God told me to do this. None of that's holding up, and including Donald Trump. And specifically the words fight like hell. Dan, it was clear then, we now have even more evidence that was clear. How many times are we gonna make this clear that he knew it was illegal and he was absolutely for it? There's no way, you're not gonna, oh, do we all have guest passes to go onto the Capitol grounds today? Hello, when? Hey, yeah. It was not a tour.
I definitely had the little fast pass you get at certain places where you go to amusement parks. You can just cut the line to go to January 6th. That's self-admission for sure. No, parody. I think you're getting to a point here where it's like, okay, you get one clown after another who is trying to make whatever defense they can possible for why they were there on January 6th, why they felt like Trump was a power that compelled them, and why this was an extra constitutional situation that got them into some extra constitutional criminal situations.
Right.
But yeah, what we're ultimately doing is beating around the bush here, because the thing that would prevent this from happening again is actually holding Donald Trump accountable. The thing that would prevent this from happening again is like actually showing, hey, constitutional originalists. There's some stuff in the Constitution that talks about what happens with people who take on insurrections on the Capitol or take on insurrections towards our country in general. And there's certain they're put in a special box, let's say, all right, where they can't do certain things. They can't run for office anymore. They can't possibly be put in a situation where they have that kind of power and they threaten this democracy again. So many peaceful transfers of power. This is the one in all of American history that this hasn't been. And the only reason the so-called party of constitutional originalists isn't aligning two and two here is because it's their guy. And for so long, they were rooting for this guy. And it doesn't seem like Donald Trump has that much juice right now. For he who has said a wrong election prediction in 2022 before the election cast the first stone. But they want Trump's base and they don't want to alienate them. And so they're playing this careful dance. But at the same time, this is really serious.
Yeah. And I think it is important because it shows that on a legal level that Donald Trump and his supporters knew what they were being asked to do, although not explicitly go and, you know, take a brick and throw it through the window or take your like flagpole and beat a cop. Like that wasn't explicit, but it was implicit that you're gonna break the law and this is what you'll have to do. And I'm glad that we're not parsing words here or like meanings and that the intention of criminality has been proven and that judges are now taking that and saying, yeah, we're going to at least, we can't go after the big fish yet, I guess, but at least these, again, the cannon fodder is seeing some time. And that's borne out in other cases as well. However, because of the January 6th commission and the findings, we now know that yes, Trump was trying to help all those people out. So yes, you've heard some of the Jan 6ers be like, Trump left us, he abandoned us. He was kind of looking out for you because he did inquire as to whether or not he could issue blanket pardons. So this is from those transcripts. John McKenzie, Mr. Trump's director of personnel, recalled in an interview how during his final days in office, the former president had floated the idea of a blanket pardon for the breach of the Capitol. But Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, had rejected it. So Cipollone said no. One day we walked into the Oval. I remember, I believe this is, John McKenzie. One day we walked into the Oval. I remember it was being discussed. And I remember the president saying, well, what if I pardon the people that weren't violent and just walked into the building? And I think the White House counsel gave him some pushback. What if I pardoned the looters who didn't take anything? They just wanted to walk through the broken glass and see what it felt like. Like, can you imagine this being extended to anybody else? You know, just like, what if I pardoned the accessories to murder, but not the actual murder? Like, no.
Well,
it's just
I was gonna say, Francesca, you're forgetting that famous moment during Donald Trump's presidency during the Black Lives Matter protests when he said, when the looting starts, the pardon starts.
Yes, I did forget. Yeah, totally.
He totally said that. We covered that. We were like, okay, anarcho Donald Trump. That definitely happened. Yeah, he was gonna pardon all the people who, listen, if you do some light looting, who among us hasn't, you know, just been at the scene of a looting and just been like, yo, mind your business. Like that's, I think we need to protect the innocent bystanders of this country.
Look,
so yeah, that's what Donald Trump's all about. Of course, he didn't say looting starts, shooting starts.
If a Walgreens is being looted and a Venus razor happens to pop at my feet, I will pick it up. They're expensive. I might put it in my pocket. Okay, but that's not otherwise. Yeah, exactly. Where's it gonna go? but it is interesting, right? So again, we are learning the limitations on all the people around him who somehow had, and I mean, surprisingly, actually had more wherewithal and had more fear of like reprisal and punishment to tell him. And these counsel, like other than Rudy Giuliani, actual lawyers who were like, no, you can't do this. You can't do that. This is continuing on. The committee referred repeatedly to pardon requests, but it singled out those from members of Congress who had attended December 21st, 2020 White House meeting, in which a plan to overturn the election had been discussed as revealing their own clear consciousness of guilt. Ooh, who were those people? Cassidy Hutchinson, please tell us. Ms. Cassidy Hutchinson told the panel that both Mr. Gates and Representative Mo Brooks, oh, of Alabama had pressed for a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting and a handful of other members that weren't at the December 21st meeting as the preemptive pardons. Mo Brooks was voted out, which I think is so delicious. He just turned on the MAGA base and he didn't really turn on them. He was like, maybe we should look to the future. And they were like, we hate the future. We want the fictitious past. But Matt Gaetz is still somehow in office, as are others who were at that meeting. If there's not a smoking, I don't know how, like how many smoking guns do we need around this, right? Like Nixon is in his grave going just like, you know, he's so mad.
You really gave it to me. Wow. It's all right there. Just come on.
I can only do Richard Nixon in Black Dynamite, which is the best depiction of Richard Nixon as a kung fu fighter. But yeah, it all goes back to, let's not like, I think you did get a little bit of optimism out of me earlier when I was like, okay, there are some incentives to not do an insurrection again, because let's say you have someone like a Trump or a Trump like trying to call for that kind of thing. All the people who are going up to the Capitol, like finding out their flights are going, huh, the FBI was able to track their flight information last time they did this. And they were able to use it against them in court, and they would charge a lot of the people who showed up there, and they found pictures of them on the internet and they lost their jobs. So there is some disincentive from that. And oh, look, is Daddy Donald not merciful? He looked into doing a couple of pardons here or there. But like at the end of the day, we have a legal system that uses the law itself, like what's written down and what's been supposedly agreed upon, as a fallback for what people really want in power, which is to sustain their own power. And so if they can find some other way to be like, okay, let's run this calculus of, we have these people who might threaten the very society we live in, but they might get us votes. Let's weigh that in to how we do our enforcement, which is sort of like a sad state of affairs in our society.
Absolutely. And the reason we're even on the other side of this talking about it and not banned from YouTube and tech platforms and are under like an authoritarian rule right now is because January 6th was unsuccessful, but not by a lot. And so the difference is that if it were successful, none of this would have happened. So yeah, some folks might be thinking who were part of the insurrection, man, I don't know, I won't be able to get a job anymore, and I shouldn't do no more insurrecting. But some of them are probably thinking, all we needed was a few more weirdos in piano key scarves, you know? Like all we needed was a few more Ashley Babbitts or whatever it was. Like all we needed was more people who were willing, or maybe we should have started shooting, right? Like that is also the lesson, because it's like, oh, we could have, we almost did it. And if they had done it, you think anyone would have seen any kind of ramification, prosecution? No. So anyway, if only they had a different vice president. I want to go to a different aspect of this, because it's pretty chilling. We're now learning, thanks to a new book about Joe Biden, that the current president, sitting president Joe Biden, is actually very wary and mistrusting of his own Secret Service. And that is because of the Secret Service's behavior on January 6th, and because a lot of them were, in fact, loyalists to Donald Trump. So this is a new book called In the Fight of His Life, Inside Joe Biden's White House. Author Chris Whipple, writes that Mr. Biden's discomfort with the post-Trump era agency began early on in his presidency, when it became clear that some of the agents charged with protecting him from assassination were strong supporters of the man he defeated in the 2020 election, former President Donald Trump. Mr. Biden's view is also a result of the increased size of the detail assigned to the chief executive, and suggested that the president shouldn't have been surprised by the presence of ex-MAGA sympathizers among bodyguards, because the Secret Service is full of white ex-cops from the South who tend to be deeply conservative. Now, I am not sure if that is a direct quote of him saying they're full of white ex-cops from the South who tend to be deeply conservative. I believe that is from the book itself. But that to me is actually fairly chilling, that the sitting president knows that his security detail, I mean, like we thought that like sage would do the trick. You know, you go up into the White House, just sage it all, and like change out the gold toilets or whatever. I gotta unclog them first from all the secret documents that Trump flushed. But you know, there was a lot of changing of the guards, but not necessarily some of these Secret Service agents. Dan, does that strike you at all? Like that we wouldn't, you know, on the one hand, you don't wanna, it's a bad habit to do what authoritarians do, which is getting rid of anyone who held the position under your predecessor, right? That's political purging, and that's actual political purging. But in this case, this is the agency charged with protecting the president. This is your security detail. It seems like you might want to do a little bit of purging.
I mean, yeah, you're right here, and I'm not gonna fault you for this, but let's not remember that Donald Trump did purging, right? So it's not purging to purge out the people who were brought in from the last purge, right?
Right, that's unpurge called the purge.
Cleaning. Yes, that's a double reverse repurge. That's a little Uno card here. I keep it on me at all times just to be safe, wow. You know. But like,
he's a prop comic, y'all. He's a prop pundit.
It's really all I can do, because we know I'm not as funny as you. But like the ultimate like. Issue, like, I'm not surprised. In fact, I'm kind of surprised that actually give it a little bit to like base dark Brandon here. That, like, okay, good. That's Brandon gets a little like +2 black points for me because he doesn't trust even the cops that are surrounding him. I feel good about that personally. I like a president who doesn't trust his cops. That's totally good. But no, like, we know just that even quote from the beginning that is saying that, the Secret Service has presidential preferences or political preferences. And so that might put me in danger. That might like have a preference towards if I'm protected or not, if someone wants to stop a bullet for me or not. Like, yeah. That's ridiculous. We shouldn't have, like, of course it's a given, it's accepted, especially in communities of color, that okay, the same institutions that are supposed to protect and serve us are largely biased against our very existence, sure. But to feel that at the very top level for like Joe Biden, who's like not the epitome of white privilege, but I mean, like, he's a white male Catholic like president, right? Like, he wasn't even like the richest senator ever, right? But like for him to feel that kind of understanding because of political bias shows you that, like we're saying all the time, there's a deep rooted cultural issue within the police that goes beyond the few bad apples trope. It's the fact that this continues to happen. The fact that, oh, we all know Jeff, he's a pro Trump guy and he definitely wouldn't take a bullet for old Brandon, but you know what? We love him. He brings in donuts every holiday. He's a good guy, right? He's good police, right? Like, that's not the vibe. That's not what we should be doing for creating a better culture of policing. And even that goes up to the Secret Service.
I mean, and then you're hitting on, I think, not the main takeaway and the place we need some real introspection and protection on January 6th, which is how to protect democracy. But it's about law enforcement. I mean, again, I said it before. Can we talk about blue on blue crime? Huh? Can we talk about all the cops that were insurrectionists who were, again, bludgeoning Capitol police officers with the American flag or with the Trump flag? So like this, you put your finger on it, Dan. It is really about policing generally. It is about who is protecting and who is serving. Are they being properly vetted? What is their background? And if their background is, I mean, honestly, like if it is just in policing, and then that's not always a good thing, right? Or if they're veterans, that's not always a good thing. What were they a part of abroad, right? Like it is political. I mean, again, to say that it's not a politicized job, or it can't be, is like, again, saying that the Supreme Court is, they're bipartisan or they're nonpartisan. Lol, right? Like, we all know that's not true. So anyway, the reason that Biden would be concerned, obviously, just going back, Whipple explains it in his book. He explained that the agency had looked both incompetent and politicized by the failures of the agents on Mr. Trump's detail to retain and turn over text messages from the 5th and 6th of January 21, the day before the Capitol attack and the day of the attack itself. It was also one of Mr. Trump's own appointees, the DHS Security Inspector General Joseph Kufari, who had asked agents for the messages and who had later told Congress that all but a single message had been irretrievably lost, while the Secret Service, ordinarily world-renowned for its technical abilities, claimed the deletions were a result of a quote, migration during schedule mobile device upgrades. Okay, who's believing that?
That was one of my favorite stories to come out of the whole thing. I remember it's like, oops, we just happened to be doing this thing during the exact time where we want a lot of evidence, where we were clearing data, and we happened to know we were doing this and don't have backups. Whoopsie darn it. That's just, you know, happens. Sorry, just
you even know, Dan, when you update your phone, like when you like move to like a whatever, you upgrade it, like it immediately erases all of your text messages.
Yeah, doesn't back it up at all. No company has figured that out. No. It's weird.
It's very strange. Shucks. But yeah, so this is obviously, we could go into the Secret Service has a long history. I don't know if you guys remember the night in Colombia. There was some strip club action happening. There was just, this was all under former President Obama. They got a shady past, so this is not the first time. All right, welcome back to the Damage Report here for Jessica Fiorentini and Dan Evans, ready to get into more news. Let's do it. So COVID cases in China are surging as a result, in part to its reversal of its zero COVID policy. And that comes after massive protests, unprecedented, unseen in these many, many years that China has been living under effective draconian lockdown because of COVID. So China recently relaxed its strict zero COVID rules after unusually widespread protests against the measures. The policies again prevented people from leaving their homes if cases were detected in their area and required regular testing for much of the population. I'm sure you guys remember people who live in massive high rises. If one person in this whatever 300 person building tested positive, the entire building gets shut down. And we're talking, yes, major cities like Shanghai, Beijing, but everywhere. And mind you, China is huge and there are many, many major cities. But the cases then, because of the reversal, are naturally going up. So they've officially reported about 5,000 cases a day this week, which honestly seems pretty low, but that's officially reported. But analysts say the numbers are vastly undercounted and the daily caseload is closer to 1 million. Yikes. Now, as a reminder again of, it sounds bad, but what was happening before? What was the cost of that zero COVID policy? In a couple of instances, this is detailed by CNN, migrant workers abandoned a lockdown Foxconn factory en masse, walking for miles to escape an outbreak at China's largest iPhone assembling site. A three-year-old boy died of gas poisoning in lockdown after he was blocked from being taken promptly to a hospital. A four-month-old girl died in hotel quarantine after a 12-hour delay in medical care. That's awful. And then was that event that sort of broke the camel's back, which was in late November, a deadly apartment fire in the western city of Urumqi finally ignited public anger that has been simmering for months. Many believe lockdown measures had hampered rescue efforts despite official denials. Before I kick it to you, Dan, just something to know is that you're like, okay, well, what's the state of vaccination in China? Not as good as you would imagine, but also not that much better, kind of on par with where the United States is at. So China has not vaccinated large segments of its most vulnerable older population. While 90% of all Chinese were reportedly fully vaccinated as of November, less than 66% of those 80 and older were fully vaccinated and only 40% had gotten a booster. So China does not have much natural immunity from past COVID waves. Its lockdown policies have kept the virus out of the country, probably saving lives in the short term. But they've also left its population more vulnerable to the disease than those who have been repeatedly exposed to the virus, as this newsletter previously explained. That was from the New York Times. And because of that, there's now new COVID restrictions for travelers coming from China into the United States. Again, remember that the United States dropped all COVID travel restrictions back in June for those entering the country, which honestly made sense because there were no travel restrictions internally and we were giving each other COVID a lot and continued to do that. But Dan, just thoughts on this. I mean, they finally caved to public pressure and now they have this obviously health emergency on their hands.
Yeah, there's so many thoughts to get from this. Like first level, seeing those like gut-wrenching stories about how because of the lockdowns you had like 4-month-old girl and a 3-month-old, a 3-year-old boy like dying because of all these situations. It's just so gut-wrenching and heartbreaking. Also gut-wrenching and heartbreaking are the millions of people around the world who have died and are continuing to die of COVID-19, because truly they're safer perhaps New Zealand. Like, no countries on earth who have really gotten this like 100% right. Most of these countries here, it's important to, daily news is important. We're keeping track of all these different things going on. Hopefully we're translating that into conversations with our friends and making change in our communities. But like, the main picture is that COVID was politicized by right wingers in the United States and around the world for political gain, to say it was the quote unquote China virus, to say that it's just some plot for people that, hey, some people are gonna need to die, but we're gonna have to keep working to keep this stuff going. And all of these measures, all of these approaches towards a crisis for humanity, save for like an alien invasion, this is probably the closest thing we're gonna get to that, where we really had an opportunity to unite and be careful. And by the way, actually care for our disabled like friends who are folks with disabilities who have particular proclivities to COVID-19, as not to say like long COVID doesn't affect all of us, whether we have disabilities or not, but this was a great opportunity for us to unite on something and actually help for the better. China thought it was doing better with its like zero COVID policy, but for the reasons you mentioned, for like the United States not vaccinating older people, for not, I don't think natural immunity is like a good like strategy, but that being said, it's a thing that's going to make it harder. The thing I'm most worried about now is that, like a lot of doctors are saying, there's a chance that because you're getting this rapid transmission of COVID-19, we know that it mutates and it like starts to really rapidly adapt. And if we get a version of COVID-19, perhaps say COVID-22 or 23, that is resistant to the vaccines that we have already, then we are in problem town USA, or like problem town world, Mr. Worldwide, because like that's a big issue.
And we already do have them. I mean, they are resistant, right? People still get COVID cases. But again, the difference between whether you're vaccinated and boosted and getting COVID versus not having any of those shots is huge and could mean, you know, a stay in the hospital or not. And so I do think that, you know, I think you're right that no government has gotten it completely 100%. And I do think that China's policies were way overblown and way too draconian. People not being able to go to work, not being able to get food. You know, that being said, China also is a country that generally attempts and tries to provide for its people. So you see crews cleaning streets. You see crews offering people, I mean, talk about free tests. There's tests everywhere. There's never a question of how or when or where to get a test. You can call that, you know, a robust social infrastructure. You could call that authoritarian, totalitarianism. I mean, I think it's somewhere in between. I think the real, to me, the interesting thing is the political fallout, which is Xi Jinping made a calculation. He was like, look, obviously I'm president for life and I will continue to be so, you know, at the barrel of a gun. But I do want to be minimally popular and I don't want people to blame me for everything. And I think going on 3 years, this has been enough. And so we need some amount of easing and relaxation given the amount of protests and given the uprising about it. So he made a political calculation and I think he's gonna save his own behind. And yes, this is naturally what was going to happen when you start to relax a little bit. I think that again, the extent to which people can be vaccinated is the extent to which they can save lives. But Dan's right, man. This was, Mother Nature is like, what do I have to do to get you to fundamentally change your goddamn system? What do I have to do? I give you a pandemic, I give you climate change, I give you all these opportunities to actually do better, humans, to take the hint. You don't take the hint.
really fast. Yeah. Like 10 seconds. Like, I really like what you said there about how, yeah, there were some things China did well. And it's important and it's very easy for us, especially in these world situations, to try to frame it in the way we usually do politics as left versus right here. But no, if we can have any semblance of a chance of learning from this and maybe doing better in the future, we have to understand that some countries that are vilified or like lionized or like overappreciated around the world, they did some things that were good and some things that were bad. And it takes a rational mind to look at it all in that full big picture and not just go China fully bad, USA fully good. So it's important to
do that. We know USA not fully good.
Again, not preaching to the converted here.
I think I'm giving New Zealand like the A on this one. I'll give him the gold.
And yeah, then, yeah. Definitely where, like in college, we're taking, okay, not everyone did a great job, so we'll like curve it. We'll take whoever totally. Did best and then go from there.
Very much so. Everyone's being graded on the curve. Dan's funny. Dan's very funny. I love Dan. All right, and into some less funny news, we got to jump into this. It's no wonder what happens when people are forced into parenthood, when they're forced to give birth to a child that they did not want and cannot provide for. And that is suicidal thoughts and potentially suicide. And it turns out, according to a new study, that in fact, when you strip people of their reproductive rights, it leads to more suicide and suicidal thoughts among those people seeking abortions. So this is a new study, and it shows that restricted access to abortions may have increased the risk of suicide among young women of reproductive age for more than 4 decades. New research from the University of Pennsylvania suggests, though suicide rates are rare, they're the second leading cause of death among women ages 20 to 24 in the United States, and the third leading cause among women ages 25 to 34. I'm going to say that's too high. What's the first? Car accidents? Gun violence? Now, again, you'll notice this is between, or this is actually between 1974 and 2016, when Roe v. Wade was still active, when it was still protecting people. However, when there were many different laws enacted throughout different states in this country to try and strip away and chip away at those reproductive rights. So one of those laws are trap laws, and we'll talk about that here. So during the period, 21 states enforced at least one targeted regulation of abortion providers, trap law, which imposed mandates on abortion providers or facilities, such as requiring facilities to be located near a hospital, requiring providers to be affiliated with a local hospital. And from 1974 to 2016, the average annual suicide rate among women of reproductive age in those states was nearly 6% higher than in prior years when the laws were not enforced. The researchers did not find the same association for older women, suggesting that the increased suicide risk was specific to women directly affected by trap laws. The researchers also ruled out other factors such as the economy or state's political climate on suicide rates. In accompanying editorial published Wednesday, Tyler Vanderweel, an epidemiology professor, thank you, at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, estimated that trap laws may have associated with around 127 suicides among women of reproductive age in 2016. That's a lot, and it actually sounds low to me. And this is the fight of our lives, women, ladies, people. And I think what I'm seeing now is young women who understand that this is impacting them and how going forward 2022 and beyond, we're not gonna take this. We look at these stats and that's not gonna wash over us. I am not between those ages of 20 and 24, but that's not gonna wash over this younger generation. That is going to have an impact. People are gonna know people who have thought about suicide, who have attempted, who have successfully killed themselves. And it's just not gonna stand. And we now have the proof that what the so-called pro-life party enacts leads to only more death. Dan, thoughts?
Yeah, you put it so very well there. This pro-life party, they're pro-life in a very theoretical sense. They're pro-life of the baby, unless that mother of that baby is an undocumented immigrant. And then once that baby is born, if they're born into poverty, we're not going to do things like Head Start programs or any sort of social services that could be paid for by taxes that would actually help people. We're not going to advocate for higher taxes on the rich to pay for any sort of social services for kids as they grow up. No. It's very much a, you know, on principle, we care about this thing, but you look at the reality. I mean, from the most egregious cases like that, one case of the underage woman being like raped essentially, and the like local officials basically trying to pass the blame around saying, oh, well, it's not like our fault that she can't seek reproductive services. Like, you get those type of circumstances, and then you get these on a societal level. Like, America is a dismal place for a lot of reasons. I think there's hope in this, like, not just this future generation, because that's a trope. They said the same thing about millennials, like, millennials will be the future. And then they they avocado toasted their way to like their demise, right? But it's important to kind of make sure we see that there are larger ramifications, there are big picture things that Republicans either didn't think about because they don't care, or they thought about because they don't care. And so it really dismantles the pro-life argument from every single angle, because what happens with that life on like day four, if they're black or like under any sort of like marginalized group, what if that baby eventually like grows up, and let's take this out of the realm of controversy and say they're 18 and they decide they're trans. Is the Republican Party pro-life then? We report you decide on that.
No, of course. I mean, I think what's the one silver lining to all of this devastation is that we are seeing a whole picture of reproductive justice, reproductive rights, and health of parents, right? Whether prenatal care, postnatal care, postpartum care, all of that. As a new mom, I can tell you, as a new mom who wants her child, caring for a newborn gets real dark when you're waking up every hour and a half in the middle of the night. And you're like, why won't you stop crying? Obviously, I don't shake. It gets tough. Now imagine layered on top of that, someone unable to take care of that kid, not with the resources to do that. Someone who didn't even want that kid. Someone in an abusive relationship. It goes on and on and on and on. And so it is no wonder that these studies exist, and they're only gonna get worse. And we have to hold each other, we have to support each other, and we have to support abortion providers and access to things like the Plan C pill. I just wanna clarify for everyone who didn't make that connection. The reason those trap laws make it more difficult is because people have to travel farther to get abortion care, right? You have to, and effectively, you don't have the time to travel. So ergo, you don't have the time to get that abortion. And a lot of young women going back to school, after the winter break or this year are going to school. I'm talking young women in college are going to school in states that have drastically changed their reproductive rights. They are at risk. We have to take our second break. Don't go nowhere. We got more after this. You know, when you've been owned, sometimes you just gotta take the L. And that is a lesson that misogynist grifter Andrew Tate has not learned. That's right. Andrew Tate, again, a guy who has become famous for being on TikTok and explaining why women shouldn't get the vote, or why women should be hit, or other fun things like that. Andrew Tate picked a fight with the wrong 19-year-old, the wrong climate activist, Greta Thunberg, this week, tweeting at her about his many cars and how they all run on gas, and how that she should send him her email, so he can tell her all about his cars. Let me tell you about your cars. And she responded, yes, send them to smalldenergy@getalife.com, which was the most brilliant own of, I think of, like, I hate Twitter now, but man, it's good for some good, for these things. Probably the best own ever. And we're talking about a platform where Ted Cruz is on there. So what did Andrew Tate do? This was a cold open and I ruined it. Andrew Tate did this. Take a look.
Release some greenhouse gases. I'm obviously a stranger to online controversy. It's not something I often do. But now the mainstream press is commenting on the fact that I was informing Greta that my very extensive car collection with internal combustion engines, which run on dead dinosaurs, have an enormous emission profile. And she replied by telling me her own email address. Greta's email address is, I have small energy. Why would that be your own email address, Greta? Strange. I mean, also, I don't want to assume her gender. It's 50-50, but it is what it is. I'm not actually mad at Greta. Please bring me pizza and make sure that these boxes are not recycled. Thank you. So I'm actually mad at Greta, right? Because she doesn't realize she's been programmed. She doesn't realize she's a slave of the Matrix. She thinks she's doing good.
She doesn't realize she's a slave of the Matrix.
That is Andrew Tate again, professional misogynist in his home movie self-own, responding to Greta Thunberg, who responded to him tweeting at her earlier this week all about his many cars and that he should email her about them. And she obviously replied, yes, enlighten me at smalldenergy@getalife.com, which was brilliant. He couldn't leave it there. He filmed that in a robe with his homies that he pays $10 an hour to be there hanging with him, spewing greenhouse gases with his cool cigar. Dan, as a man, I think you need to weigh in on what is going on here. It is beyond my comprehension.
Yo, friend, I love you so much. Why are you giving me that stray all of a sudden? Like, here you are shooting, and all of a sudden, like, I'm the innocent bystander. It's like, Dan, as a man, can you please? No,
well, can you please psychoanalyze this fragility for me?
No, I'm not Freud. No, first of all, she was born in 2003. Her birthday is January 3rd. So her birthday's coming up. Shout out Greta Thunberg. She's going to be 20 soon. Yeah. This 20-year-old girl lives rent-free in this so-called alpha male's brain. Yeah, I'm calling the Romanian cops right now. Like, absolutely. But like this whole you must be so, it's always the people who are so deep in the Matrix who say, you're the one who's deep in the Matrix. Shout out to Elon Musk over here. I have the tweet who's all like, I'm not being owned. I'm not being brainwashed or whatever. Maybe you could edit that in so it's like better. But that like meme he posted where he's like, that guy who was all like, has all the different Black Lives Matter and all that stuff on there, like Twitter, Facebook logos. These people have such a caricature of how politics is in America. They think that, I don't recycle my pizza boxes. Dude, okay, I'm a recycle freak. You can't recycle pizza boxes because they have grease on them, so it doesn't work. Guess what? I'm also a car freak as a guy. And all those cars you're talking about, I'm Andrew Tate. I got the brand new Bugatti with the V12. Those are sold in Europe. Europe has strict car regulations for like emissions. So whatever kind of car you have, like even if it's the classics, you don't drive it a lot because otherwise like you're not a car guy and you're even less of a man than you portray to be. But if it's a new car, congratulations, baller, you got a new car. It abides by European like emission standards. So it's not all like it's gas powered, whatever, like it could be better. I own an electric car and electric cars also are bad for the environment, it turns out. So yeah, like,
but it's not a 1998 Suburban, because soccer moms, I think, emit more CO2s than those things do.
For sure, right? But like this is such the overall thing with Andrew Tate, and hopefully this is one of the last times I ever have to talk about this loser, is that it is male performance in a way that like gas station horny goat weed does better, right? Yes. Like it is such like easy to see through. Even the Andrew Tate heads are like, man, dog, can you just hold this L and stop fighting this 20-year-old girl? Like, it's not a good look, man. Like, can you please? Like, I have never, like, ever since loose friend of the show Hassan like dunked on him a while ago, like I haven't seen Andrew Tate like down this bad trying to be like, I'm not owned. One last thing, all the people who are in the Matrix who claim they're not brainwashed, even though they are the like most legitimately brainwashed, they don't have their own political thoughts people ever. They always love to say, like, they double down. They Streisand effect themselves. They keep talking when they've been owned, which is great content for us. Like, it's awesome. It makes me laugh, but also it keeps us talking about them. It's like they're trying to feed the energy while like someone of actual relevance like Greta Thunberg has given them that. So
yeah,
other than like this little video here, we psychoanalyze that and kind of like give it our perspective. I'm not going to be giving him the attention he so craves.
No, I know but it's interesting who he picked a fight with, right? Like it was like, and again, this is a young girl, a young woman who has triggered the most powerful men in the world, right? Donald Trump couldn't take it, could not take that Greta Thunberg was the person of the year. Just like it made him absolutely furious. And I love that. And it also just shows you, like, it's why people hate AOC. It is not just that they are incredibly, they're incredible leaders. It's not that they've sacrificed. It's not that they're inspiring. It is also that their ideas are better. Their ideas are more popular. Yes, people like that. People want to rein in climate change. People are in lockstep with Greta Thunberg. And this fool, I'm sorry, how many people on Twitter, how many people out there, you got 6 Bugattis, you got 7, 8 cars? No, we don't. Sorry, I have way more in common with Greta Thunberg than I do with Andrew Tate. And yet, the way, Dan, I'm sorry, just the way he was like, so why would you have your email be small D energy, huh? I don't know. Like, bro, you know she made a joke. You know you were the butt of that joke. You know, don't be corny. Like, don't pretend like you don't understand the joke, because that makes it even worse. It's like, you know, it's just like it's grade school stuff. It's a grade school. Why would you? I know you are, but what am I? He literally could have said, I know you are, but what am I?
No, thank you. Like, that, it's grade school stuff. Like, I believe it or not, Dan from the internet was a problem child. And so I ended up like bullying the bullies at a certain point. Like, this is the kind of stuff that I would have been okay taking in like a suspension over if I got to punch someone in the face. Cause like, I know you are, but what am I? Or like, you said this was your email address, but obviously it has to like rely on me, or has to be like referential to me. It's like, yo, I'm sorry, he's not taking his L hard enough. I'm gonna take matters into my own hands, quite literally. The damage comport doesn't condone violence. But I'm just saying, this is grade school stuff. Like, the people who admire Andrew Tate, first of all, find God or therapy. Second of all, like, hopefully you see how bad this is, like how much he is clout chasing after this girl.
Wait, we have to watch the second clip before we wrap. Throw up the second clip so we can just underscore just how bad it is.
Someone has sat her down and convinced her to try and convince you to beg your government to tax you into poverty to stop the sun from being hot. And then, because I called her out on it, the global matrix got this bot farm to like and retweet and all this bot commenting to try and pretend that her telling me that she has a small email address somehow teaches me a lesson. Welcome to a new episode of The Clown Show. But now I know, at least, that Greta, with a little hate-filled face, bitter, sitting somewhere without the heating on, in the cold, a little hat, shivering, views my tweets, which is gonna make my Twitter account far more fun into eternity.
Whatever you say bounces off of me and sticks to you. I'm rubber and you're glue.
He's like, you actually made me more famous because your bots retweeted. And then his little friend is like holding the camera, like, or like the phone. Let's just, oh God, I'm sorry, but you know, the small D energy, maybe that was a low blow, but Dan, could anyone argue that he doesn't have it after that clip? Like, honey.
If there's anyone who looks like he needs a positive male role model in his life, it's probably Andrew Tate. He needs some, like, dude, I live so great. I'm not gonna brag about my life. There's no necessary need to, but the amount of time I like don't think about this stuff, or like I decide to just not target 20-year-olds, and I live a fine, comfortable in my like bisexual, cisgendered like body and nature. Like, I'm fine, dude. Like, I don't get why you need to continue doing this. So unnecessary. This is not manly. That's all I'll say. Like, take whatever coded gendered BS about that stuff. It's not manly.
No, it is not. No, it will not get chicks. I'm sorry. That is the first hour of the show, but there's more in the aftermath. I will remember that there is an aftermath today. after this brief, brief break. Thank you guys so much. If you're on Linear, and if you're not, then head over to YouTube. I think that's how it works. Okay, see ya.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.